You know, I know two people are glad he's not running for president.
Hey, that was my line. All right. I thought you all were
who are glad he didn't run earlier.
Exactly.
Thank you both for being here. I thought you were going to be the highlight of the program, but no. It's debatable at this point.
I didn't think anybody could top Mark Cuban.
Yeah.
He was great. Thank you for being here, Mark. We really appreciate it.
President Clinton, welcome back to the Bush Center. We're thrilled you're here. And just a quick personal privilege, it has been a delight to get to work with your team, especially Bruce Lindsay and Valerie Alexander, Stephanie Street, and Mike Hemphill. We love each other. We've had a blast working together.
Well, I think everybody knows that you were the spark plug that made this happen, and we were glad to be asked to help.
That's not why I said it.
And it succeeded beyond my wildest dreams. So thank you very much for giving us a chance to do something that I think is of lasting importance.
Well, and we all echo, obviously, Jake's sentiments. So without further ado, it seems like just yesterday that Josh Bolton was sitting in my place in Washington launching this program together just last September, 10 months ago. And so here we are graduating this awesome class. So let me start by asking the importance of the two of you working together. That particular feature has meant a whole lot to the scholars. And you've both had the opportunity to spend some time with the scholars. What have you thought of him as you've gotten to know him? What's impressed you about him? What's surprised you about him? What do you think of this generation of leaders? President Bush?
Well, you know, Mark said something very interesting in that he runs into pessimistic people about the future of the country. And I understand that. I do, too. But when you meet these scholars, you can't be pessimistic about the future of the country. These are really fine people who, inspire hope. Clinton and I are getting a little long in the tooth these days.
This is the 1 month of the year when he's older than me. So speak for yourself.
Yeah, I'm a month longer in the tooth. I guess as you get longer in the tooth, and as society moves on, there's a tendency for some to be pessimistic. And my advice is hang out with the scholars.
President Clinton?
Yeah, I think the one thing that I found particularly interesting about this group, that I liked them when they were admitted, but when I read more about their specific projects and when we were preparing to come here, is that they're diverse in every way. They don't just look different and think different. They have different skills. They have different things. And to think that we have this much talent and this much innovation going into so many different aspects of our national life. I'm like you. I don't get people who are down on our future. I'd rather be America looking ahead what I think the world will look like in 20 or 30 years. I like our chances. We are younger than every big country but China. If they hadn't changed their one-child policy, we'd have been younger than China in 20 years. And if we get a good immigration reform, which you tried to do and which I hope we'll get, we'll stay young. Either that or we're going to have to encourage that young woman who works for you that I met today to keep having more babies. Because having lost it, I can tell you, youth matters. Youth matters. But I like our chances, and I think everybody who sees, you got to, besides all the other advantages, it's the people that matter. And as long as this is a free country and people are free to debate and free to be creative, and as long as when it really matters we can come together, and I have to say this, that I almost cried when I saw that picture of the South Carolina legislature yesterday with the Republicans and the Democrats and the African Americans and the white people embracing each other and making that vote and seeing the decisive speech made by a woman who was a direct descendant of Jefferson Davis. Don't tell me that we can't get together across the lines that divide. We just have to keep working at it.
Yeah. So, as you know, these scholars have had an opportunity to study your decisions through this case study approach, as well as those of President H.W. Bush and LBJ. And so take a minute and talk about your decision-making process, President Clinton. How do you know when it's time to decide? These are questions our scholars want to know. And how do you move on and not get totally tied in knots over your decisions?
First of all, I think knowing when it's time to decide is a big deal. You have to know, to answer that question, what all's going on and what kind of decision you're making. That is, if you make a mistake, is it irrevocable? If so, then you maybe ought to take a little more time. But there are a lot of decisions where a decision that's on a scale of 1 to 100, 70% right today is better than a decision that's 100% right 6 months from now when the train has left the station. And so that's what I always ask myself, are the consequences irrevocable? I'll give you one example. Whenever we were getting ready to bomb somebody, sometimes my advisors would say, if you don't do this today, you'll look weak. We'll look so weak. And I always said, can I kill him tomorrow? Now you're laughing, but think about this. I said, because I can't bring him back to life tomorrow. If the answer is yes, I can kill him tomorrow, then we're not weak. So let's debate whether we should do it today. On the other hand, there are those decisions that you literally will paralyze yourself if you don't just go in and make. Because waiting for 6 months so you can get 100% right is foolish. And I think to make the best decisions, you have to have people that know things you don't know, who will tell you what you don't want to hear, and who aren't afraid to debate. And you have to have a sense when the time has come to decide.
President Bush?
Well, he's a lot of wisdom there. But sometimes the circumstance, at least during my presidency, the circumstance made it really imperative you decide. And decide decisively. I guess the thing that dominated my administration was an enemy that wanted to kill again. And therefore, I had to make decisions that protected the homeland. I mean, that was my goal. And some of the decisions that I had to make needed to be made fairly quickly because the enemy, that sadly still exists, doesn't really care about whether a president agonizes over a decision or not. And I think the most important point for the scholars is, and Bill said this, is to know what you don't know and find people who do. In other words, sometimes when you get to be real powerful, the tendency is to say, I must know everything. Otherwise, I wouldn't be so powerful. And you don't. And it's essential that you know yourself first and find people who are capable of fighting through all the trappings of power and give you their good advice. I got a couple here in this room, you, Josh. I mean, people like that I don't think would have served in my administration if they felt their primary job was to make me look good, which was an impossible task to begin with. Jake's talk about, strategy and principle are really important that everybody in the team knows, and that the environment is such that the sycophants aren't allowed in. I don't know if that makes any sense, but...
President Bush...
They told me to use some big words.
Use properly.
Yeah.
President Bush...
This is the point where I reach in my back pocket to make sure my billfold's still there. I don't know any big words. I'm just a itinerant portrait artist.
Right.
Uh-huh.
President Bush?
Yes.
Okay. So the scholars read your father's book about relationships and building relationships over time.
Yeah, my only question is, why didn't they read mine?
They did.
Oh, they did.
Good. They did.
Good,
they did.
Thank you.
But it talked about, obviously, his letter writing and his development of relationships over many years, not just when you need something, but,
right,
you know, over time. And so talk about what they should learn from your dad and how you all have developed relationships.
Well, one of the most remarkable relationships that I described in the book called 41, which a lot of copies in the store over here, was a relationship that Bill had with my dad. So losing an election isn't fun. I've lost one. You've lost one. He lost one to him. And yet they ended up having a friendship. So you got to ask the question, how does it happen? How do, like, what people think are bitter enemies in the political arena able to put aside victory and defeat? I think in Dad's case that winning and losing an election was not the most central thing in his life. The most central things in his life turned out to be his faith and his family. And therefore, it makes it much easier to deal with disappointments on the daily occurrences of life. Secondly, it helped a lot that Bill was so gracious. In other words, it's important to be a humble winner. And I find that relationship to be very instructive. That's why I spent a fair amount of time in Chapter 7 on it. So one of my favorite stories, for those of you who haven't heard this and didn't read the first book I wrote, was when I introduced Putin to Barney. Now, Barney was our Scottish Terrier, and he dissed him. He basically kind of body language said, "You call that a dog?" And to the extent that it hurt my feelings, I didn't let him know. Anyway, so a year later, Putin says, "You want to meet my dog?" And I said, "Sure." Out bounds this giant Russian hound. And Putin looks at me and says, "Bigger, stronger, and faster than Barney." Now, you could take umbrage at something like that, but so the point of the story is, I learned a lot about Putin then. Like I said, my dog is bigger than your dog, you know? it's instructive. The lesson is, listen carefully to what others say. Don't prejudge their sentiments, and let them speak. And 41 was a great personal diplomat because he listened to the other person a lot.
Mm-hmm. President Clinton, when you were with the scholars in Little Rock, you had a great discussion with them, and you said that if you don't have respect for your adversary, if you don't believe that the other guy is well-intended, means to do right, then you're not going to get very far with them. What are some of the ways that you've worked to understand the other guy's point of view, the other person's point of view?
Well, I think I said this when we had the opening of the presidential, all these folks. I can't remember the
launch.
Anyway, my family raised me to believe in a storytelling culture, and I couldn't tell one until I could listen to one and reiterate it. And one of the most enduring stories of my childhood was my eighth grade science teacher, who was not an attractive man, telling me that none of us would ever remember anything we had in eighth grade science. So we should remember this. He said, "Every day I get up and I start the day in the bathroom, throwing water in my face, putting shaving cream on, shaving, then washing my face off. And I look in the mirror and say, 'Vernon, you're beautiful.'" And he said, "You just remember this. Everybody wants to believe they're beautiful. If you remember that, it'll take you a long way." And I have tried to remember that. And I remember this one other quick example. The loss of trust is paralyzing this country and this world. 20 years ago this fall, Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin was murdered by a fellow Israeli because he presided over the first big handover of land in the West Bank to the Palestinians. The whole thing was nearly screwed up because one of the maps they were signing said a road belonged to Israel that Arafat thought was his. I told him to go in and fix it, figure out what the truth was, but we were late and the World Press Corps was waiting. So they walked out. Rabin says, he's right, that road should be his. It was a road to Jericho around a Christian monument. I said, well, what are we going to do? He said, Arafat says, we're going to go sign the maps. I said, now you realize we signed these maps, they belong to Israel as a matter of international law. And Arafat, for all of his faults, and he had a lot of them, looked at me and he said, oh, Rabin's word is worth more than any written contract. He said, yeah, I'm going to give him the road tomorrow. And he did. Now, you cannot imagine somebody doing that today over there, can you? I'm telling you, if people trust each other, everything else is possible. And if they don't, I don't care how good an argument they make, how many people they listen to, it's very hard to get anything done.
So for both of you, in Austin, the LBJ Library did a terrific job of hosting them, and the scholars had the opportunity to learn about communication. Of course, LBJ is well known for his physical presence and his relentless style and so forth, and they listened to the tapes of him talking in real time to Martin Luther King and Everett Dirksen and so forth as he negotiated the Voting Rights Act. So talk about your persuasive style and how you adapt it to a particular situation, when to push, when to cajole, when to hold, when to fold. President Clinton.
Well, sometimes, first of all, you got to know who you're trying to persuade. When I was working with other world leaders, I never, consciously at least, made an argument for what was in America's interest. I always told them why what I thought was right for America was in their interest. In other words, these other people didn't hire on to help you or this country. They hired on to help their people and their perception of it. So I think whenever you're arguing with someone else, it proves you listen to them. You have to listen very carefully to other people. But if you should always make the argument in terms of their interest. When I was trying to persuade in Congress, I tried to figure out if there was anything they wanted that I could in good conscience give them. And if there was, I did it. And sometimes we were right at the border of the definition of in good conscience. There's a reason Mark Twain said the two things people should never watch being made are sausage and laws. And I think it was a mistake to get rid of these earmarks because it's harder for the president to argue. And I think sometimes Congress knows better than federal employees what the best way to spend money is in their districts. So anyway, I think it's different for different conditions. But first, you got to be able to listen to who it is you're trying to persuade and see if you can respond on the merits or changing the subject.
President Bush, I've watched you do this for years.
Yeah.
And you're real good at it.
Thank you.
Talk about
why?
How you persuade people. Well, you tell me why you think so.
I think that it is important to earn capital to spend capital. In other words, I can remember on the tax cut plan, trying to get out of the recession, that I would go to a state where I had done well politically. And, Ben Nelson, he was a Democrat senator in Nebraska, frankly, an endangered species. And so I went to his state, flew him down on Air Force One, as I recall, and did a tax cut event with him there, and trying to get his vote. And we got it. I think that, my only point is you can earn capital all kinds of ways in the political process. There are some people that are just not going to vote with you at all. Mm. And so it's frankly important not to waste your time. On the other hand, I do think it's important to create an environment amongst even those who are less likely to vote for you to of cordiality. I mean, one of the most unique relationships I had was with Ted Kennedy. A lot of it had to do with you. And there were some issues we could agree on, a lot of issues we didn't agree on, but I knew when to try to convince him on what issues. In other words, you got to know the people you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. Republicans were generally easier for me to work with, particularly when I was riding high. A little more of a challenge after 06. but it turns out that if you're polite, kind, considerate to people, they're a lot more likely to listen to you.
Give an example of that on the international stage, that sort of persuasive, and when we're watching the debate, the negotiations on the deal right now. But talk about use of that persuasive style in an international setting.
Well, by the time the issues get up to the president, there's been a lot of persuasiveness going on. Mm-hmm. It's what you have a Secretary of State for in a National Security Council for. And generally, the issues are pretty cooked by the time you get there. And always, well, just a lesson, and I know Cuba knows this, never negotiate principal to advisor unless you're the one providing the advisor. In other words, you always want somebody playing their hand, and the person has to go back and say, well, I got to make sure Bush okays it. And so I never got myself in a position where the person said, well, I've got to get back to my principal. So always go principal to principal if you're negotiating. Never go you're the principal to it with a non-principal. I don't know if I've confused that or not.
Yeah,
you understand it?
Yeah.
Well, then they'd understand it.
Yeah.
And so I'm kind of avoiding your question.
Okay, I'll move on then if you'd like me to.
I got to know these. Look, yeah. I had 26 meetings with Putin, yeah. One-on-one, more or less, I think. And I'm not exactly sure. And every one of them started with, how's your family? So Laura and I went to his house, met his little girls. And there's, you know, a dad loves to talk about his kids and his daughters. And so I started off, how's your daughters doing? No matter how difficult the subject would be, the whole purpose was to try to create, you know, a human bridge, a connection. And then we'd get to the issues at hand.
So one of our scholars observes that obviously you all have an authentic friendship. You spend time together and really enjoy it. And I know you know some of the folks that are running for president. And so the question is... What are your thoughts on the way the candidates, can elevate the discourse so that it's foundational for governing? And then tell a few stories from the campaign trail. You've been on it for many years, both of you.
Yeah.
President Bush, you want to start?
Well, you know, I think the discourse generally is lowered by surrogates. And the internet is a brutal place these days for political figures because there's a high degree of anonymity. There's no personal responsibility whatsoever. People can say whatever they want to say, and it kind of becomes currency. I suspect, I know Jeb, and I'm confident Secretary Hillary will, you know, elevate the discourse. I can't attest to their surrogates. I can attest to this surrogate. I'm not going to be a surrogate, but it's. but I, you know, look, I think American people expect to be, you know, some sharp elbows in a campaign. I think what really discourages them post campaign, that the inability to govern in a way that is, you know, is congenial, and hopefully that'll change. It tends to go in cycles, by the way.
Yeah, President Clinton, then we'll get to some funny stories.
I may be naive. They say you get naive when you get long in the tooth. but, you know, I think they ought to have these debates, both in the Republican primary and the Democratic primary. And I think that that I expect it to be very vigorous in the primaries, and then whoever wins the two primaries will have a hard debate. But they need to keep in mind that what we are trying to do is to take the advantages America has, and as Mark Cuban said, we talked about it, we're well positioned, but we haven't proved yet that we can solve the problem that's bedeviling the world, that is, that we can create so many jobs that we have a large percentage of our workforce in, and we can have shared prosperity. And we ought to show respect for the debate by trying to be as specific and clear as we can about the policy choices before us. And we can trust the American people and ennoble the process just by saying, look, it's not that simple. If it were simple, we'd already done it. But these are the five things we think are most important, and this is what I would do about them. I think the more we can keep it on that, and the less we can just do what I see in the so much in the media today is this sort of culture of anger and resentment. We got to reside, you know, kind of rise above anger to answers. It resides above resentment to a real response. Because if you get this job, I can tell you, the next day, it doesn't matter what was wrong with your opponent in the election. Next day, you're on your own. You walk in there, and you don't have somebody to debate you sitting behind the Oval Office desk with you, whichever desk you pick. You got to show up for work and make decisions. So that's all I hope. I hope we clarify for the American people that this is a big bunch of choices. They're not simple, but we can do it. Look, the quality of these young people proves it, and the inherent assets and the system of freedom and choice we have proves it, but we got a lot of tough decisions to make. That's all I really care about, besides I know who I like to win. But the more important thing for America is that we know what the heck we're deciding on, and we make a pretty good decision.
So we're about to graduate these scholars. What advice do you have for them as they return to their communities? And, you know, obviously you heard Jake's call to action. What's your advice for them?
Don't watch a lot of TV.
Read like Mark Cuban.
That actually act. You know, do things. And don't be afraid of failure. I'm not worried about this crowd.
President Clinton?
Yeah, I agree with that. You know, the other thing I'd say is if it, whatever it is, doesn't work out, get up. I lost two elections. I was the youngest former governor in American history after the Reagan landslide. I had one guy appointed to the cabinet walk across Main Street in Little Rock to avoid being seen shaking hands with me for fear that the guy that beat me would fire him. That was a humbling experience. And I think you got to realize there's no personal ambition you have which can be extinguished by anybody else. Only you, by giving up your dreams, can extinguish them. And if it doesn't work out exactly like you intended, it'll still take you someplace interesting and you'll make a difference. So my advice is what George said, don't be afraid to fail. But you probably will, whether you're afraid to or not. And it's scary. You just got to get up. The world belongs to tomorrow, not yesterday. Don't give anybody else permission to take your life away. Just keep living and keep giving. And never make the perfect the enemy of the good. Never think that what I'm doing is too little to make a difference. That's not true. That's not true. Do something every day. Someday, for all of us, it'll be our last day. And what will matter were all the steps we took along the way and what they amounted to, not the home run we hit on day X. And I wish you well.
President Bush, you want to add to that?
Huh?
I said, do you want to add to
that? I was stuck on that someday maybe your last day line. I thought that was pretty damn profound.
So this is maybe a good setup for this question. Our scholars have said that they were surprised by both of you. that you were not what they expected, because they thought, you know, what they read the newspaper.
One of them probably thought I couldn't read.
The other one thought I could, and I didn't realize it was impossible.
So how do you react to that with respect to the filter of the media and how to, you know, what that means for them as they try to present their, you know, true selves and have people understand who they are, understand, know their heart and so forth?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think we're both pretty confident people. And if people don't get us, what we're all about, then, you know, you just got to keep moving on. I mean, there's I try not to worry about it. I can't tell you the number of people who've told me that meet me say, "You're a lot taller than I thought you were."
So I'm not sure that's exactly what they meant.
Been 5'11" since I was 18. I don't know. I mean, image is image, and you got to be confident in what you believe in. If you have a set of beliefs that you're willing to defend, image doesn't matter. And yeah, you get people say things about you all the time, but if that's a criteria for success for you, then go into the fetal.
I would also say, you know, and if you cover political news, you have to realize that it's sort of in the nature of things. Conflict is better news than concord. Even though cooperation works better than conflict, if that's all you put on the evening news at night, you go broke. Mm. So the nature of evening news will be to make people into two-dimensional cartoons instead of three-dimensional people. Mm. It's just the nature of the beast. And I think... So you just need to always keep your little caution light burning in the back of your head on that. I also think the nature is, like, if, let's suppose we were in a campaign against each other, he would have his narrative and I would have mine, and we would try to convince you, each of us, that our narrative was better than the others. That's okay. But the people covering the campaign, they develop a narrative too. A storyline, and when it's almost impossible for the real story to be the same as a storyline, and it's very hard for the American people to be well informed if the storyline swamped the real story. So you just have to keep all that in mind as you try to be good citizens and still show up. Most important thing is showing up.
So we want some people to show up for the second class of scholars, and we're launching the recruitment today, and people can apply, those who are watching live stream, at presidentialleadershipscholars.org. So for those who are pondering application to this awesome program, what advice do you have for those seeking a spot?
And email those that have just gone through it and see whether it's worth your time. I mean... there's no better testimony to what's happened than people getting ready to walk across this stage. And my advice is, I'm sure they'll be more than willing to share their stories with you or go to our websites. Don't you think it's a good idea?
I think that's an excellent idea, President Bush. President Clinton, what do you think? What advice would you have? Or how should we...
You're kind of running out of...
No, how should people distinguish... I thought you were going to have more stories.
We're at the bottom of the barrel of the questions. God, you know.
Okay.
Why don't you just get the graduation going?
Okay. Know? Well, but first I have to ask you about being a grandparent. And you're about to have a second grandchild.
Yeah.
When we did this first time, mm-hmm. when we started this program, he said to me that when you become a grandfather, you fall in love all over again. And that's what happened. Hillary and I have our granddaughter for 3 days. And I came down here and left her like to kill me today. But Hillary was ecstatic. And she wasn't a candidate for anything. She was grandmother of the year. And last night, my granddaughter, 9.5 months old, for the first time when I walked in the room, she said, "Oh, there's your granddad," and she turned around and pointed at me. That was worth more than anything anybody had said or done for me or paid to me or anything else. And I don't know about the Sundays. Everything you said about it is true.
Yeah. Well, last night my granddaughter spoke to me in Mandarin.
What? What did you say?
I think that's the end of the program, I think. Everybody, please join me in thanking the two grandfathers.